Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Waters of Mnemosyne, Ancient Greek Religion for Modern Pagans, by Gwendolyn Rees, narrated by April Doty. Introduction: The Mnemosyne Affirmation. Remember who you are. Remember what you are. You are the radiance of the light eternal. You are beauty beholding the beautiful. You are the love that is moved by wonder. Call yourself back to yourself and remember. Strike your own true note and then feel all within tune and harmonize. You are a singer in the cosmic song. Tune yourself and sing. This healing meditation was a gift from Apollon, Lord of Light. Mnemosyne, Mother of the Muses, is the goddess of memory, and drinking her waters restores us to wholeness. Memory has a special place in ancient Greek religion. Each of us, according to Plato, is part of the source of all, and we can access truth through a special type of memory. The Mnemosyne affirmation reminds us that our individuated selves are unique expressions of that highest nature, and that our work here is holy. The waters of Mnemosyne protect us from Lethe, the waters of forgetting, which is what makes death so fearful. Many inscriptions convey a formula from the Orphic Mysteries to assist initiates in maintaining continuity of consciousness across the bridges of death and rebirth. I believe, I remember. This is my rendering of the formula the newly dead should say during their transition. I am a child of earth and starry heaven, but my race is of heaven alone. Give to me the waters of Mnemosyne, which are mine to drink by right. The power of Mnemosyne's waters can heal us individually and culturally by connecting us to the divine realm, bringing more of its light down. We can recover things we collectively lost and create new alternatives that are in greater alignment with the divine ideas. This book is dedicated to remembering and rebirthing ancient Greek religion for contemporary practitioners as inspiration for contemporary practitioners within the modern pagan movement. The Greek gods are reaching out, making connections with people today, often felt as curiosity or an internal urging that keeps resurfacing. For some, it may be an old relationship reawakening. For others, it could be a beautiful new contact. Why rebirth ancient Greek religion within modern paganism? Modern paganism, as a new religious movement, has the potential to help create alternative culture. When I look around, I see an insane society, full of deep soul sickness. Our society claims to have conquered superstition through reason, yet we are well into an ecological crisis and can't seem to muster the collective will to address it. We have record loneliness and disaffection. The world is full of suffering resulting from human-created systems. We pursue technological advances that might destroy all humanity because we fear if we don't, someone else will beat us to it. Many people lack a sense of purpose. Most tellingly, our society treats living beings as things, reducing our value to our productivity. This suffering is rooted in collective cultural and social decisions. We need to create and embrace different alternatives. Modern pagans discovered that the great ones we collectively left in the conversion to monotheism remain, waiting to be in relationship with us again. We found that if we stop treating living beings as things and begin to see all life, including the green world of the plants, the rivers, the mountains, the land itself, as having consciousness and as capable of being in friendly relationships with us, the world becomes enchanted again. Modern pagans realized we exist on many levels of reality and began taking our full selves seriously. We found that the parts of us that walk in dreams can be trained to walk those lands while waking. In those inner planes, we discovered there are lines of power that were abandoned, but still present. All we have to do is plug back into them, and we can bring that power back into the world as an act of healing. When looking at ancient forms, there will be things we don't want to recreate, but we can rebirth them in new ways, appropriate for now. Nothing living is static. The tyranny of common sense may tell us our current circumstances are just the way things are. But this illusion obscures a myriad of options. I want to do my part in trying to create healthy alternatives for myself, my beloveds, my community, my society, and for this blessed earth. I believe many of the great ones, the gods in Greek, the Theoi, want the same. They want to be in relationship with us again and help us realign the way things are with the way things should be if we were living in a healthy way. May this book be of service. Who am I? I make no sense to myself without reincarnation. I don't remember a time in which I didn't love the Greek gods and when they weren't real to me. This connection does not come out of my blood, nor from my upbringing. In the deepest and immortal part of my own nature, I feel the intense love for these beings, especially for Apollone, Apollo, Artemis, and Athena. I believe I carry these relationships with me, no matter what form I wear, and that I hold in my soul certain memories from long ago. My relationships with the Theoi have continued to evolve, change, and grow, as all living things do. My love spurs me to learn as much as I can, including pursuing advanced degrees and striving to live a pious and philosophical life as a priestess of Apollone and Athena. While I have tremendous regard for the Greeks and their endeavors to revive traditional polytheism, my path and practice are more generally embedded in modern paganism and address the needs of the modern pagan movement. I am not just a pagan. I am a witch. I practice magic regularly. Magic is not the same thing as spiritual development. It can aid spiritual evolution, and I try and use it for these purposes, as well as for living more fully in the world. I am engaged in rebirthing rather than reconstructing. Little I do is an exact recreation of ancient rites. My practice is grounded in history, but I use the past to inform, to inspire, and to tap lines of power and connection, rather than striving for historical accuracy. While I have a scholarly background, I am not writing as a scholar, studying a dead tradition. I am a theologian, writing theology as part of a living pagan tradition. My work in service to the Theoi centers on relationships. Building relationships with the non-human and spirit world and the invisible and immortal aspects of our own nature is the root of all religions. The functions of religions are relatively stable, but the forms shift to fulfill those functions in changing and varied contexts. The Theoi want us to be full spiritual adults. We are not peers, since we are not the same. But my relationship with the Theoi is characterized by partnership. There are varying levels of intimacy, just as in human relations. My relationship with Apollone being the most intimate. I understand myself to be apprenticed to him. I am learning from him, striving to be like him, and mediating some of his power into this world. There is a kind of guidance and closeness that differs from my relationships with other Theoi. Purpose and structure of this book. My goal is to give, in a single volume, everything you need to build a rich practice, conceptual knowledge, technique and process, and direct introduction to the Theoi. I hope to inspire you to view the world differently by recovering some important concepts from ancient Greece that inform practice. All major domains of ancient Greek religion are addressed with thoughts about how they are, or could be, rebirthed now. Working in vision. Working in vision, working directly in aspects of reality that are not physical, sometimes called the astral, is an important part of my practice. Many ancient sanctuaries continue to exist there, and beings can be encountered in vision. This is not metaphoric. I have seen results manifest in the physical after beginning in vision. This book will help you navigate. I give initial journeys that are maps, getting you to certain locations on the inner planes. I also encourage you to build on the inner planes. Information provided will help you do this effectively. Practice design. While sometimes reconstructing an ancient practice is exactly what is needed, the forms of ancient Greek religion are often not appropriate, practical, or meaningful in our current circumstances. Still, using something from the ancient setting or rediscovered on the inner planes will make the work more powerful while fulfilling the necessary religious function. Many practices given in this book are designed this way, to be relevant and functional in our context. Instructions. Work through this book in order. Later chapters assume knowledge provided earlier. Exercises are clearly noted. Pathworkings are guided journeys in the inner planes that will safely take you to locations and introduce you to divine contacts, including the Theoi. Record yourself repeating these pathworkings. Listen to them in a quiet place where you will be undisturbed, and shift your focus into the aspect of yourself that walks in dream. Once you have used the pathworkings enough to know your way, you can go on your own and have unscripted experiences. All experiential activities are intended to give you a launch pad to develop your own practices. There are prayers, rituals, spells, and instructions, but real religion is always growing and changing. Once you are well grounded, I hope you use your developing knowledge and contacts to create novel practices that work for you and your community. Chapter 1. Fundamentals. This chapter provides foundational information to deepen your understanding of later chapters. Included is a spatial and chronological introduction to ancient Greece and a discussion about information sources. Fundamental concepts that are crucial to an ancient Greek worldview and enrich the perspectives of contemporary practitioners are examined. The exercises will assist you in incorporating the concepts into your thinking. The Greek world, space and time. If you ever have the opportunity to visit Greece, I urge you to seize it. As an American, descended from uprooted and mobile ancestors, prior to my first visit, my perception of Greek mythology was abstract and romantic. What a joyful shock to discover the myth's immediacy when you find yourself standing in Lerna, where Heracles killed the Hydra, or sitting beside a palm tree in Delos in the exact spot where Leto gave birth to Apollon. Everything from myth is suddenly hyperlocal and immediately present. This experience of immediacy and hyperlocality was soul-healing. Below the threshold of consciousness, all living beings and cultures are shaped by their landscape. Greece is geologically very new. When dinosaurs roamed the earth, it was under the Tethys Sea. The entire region is a clash of tectonic plates pushing up mountain after mountain that rise out of the water. To this day, Poseidon, the Earthshaker, remains exceptionally active. In the middle of the Cycladic Islands in the Aegean Sea is the Ring of Fire, with active volcanoes bringing both periodic destruction and their blessed gift, obsidian, strong enough to cut stone. Obsidian enabled amazing art, technology, and trade all the way back to Neolithic times. Greece is one of the most mountainous countries in Europe. It may not look large on the map, but its actual surface is greater than it appears, since so much is vertical. Olive trees, which can bear fruit for up to 2,000 years, thrive everywhere. While there are some fertile plains that are lush and productive, easily cultivated land is limited. From early days, Family planning and a low birth rate were essential because the land could only support a limited population. Ancient Greek families concentrated their resources into fewer children. The universal acceptance and even expectation of same-sex sexual behavior was likely related to the moral and practical emphasis on population control. Even with careful family planning, periodically the population would expand beyond what the landscape could support. When that happened, the polis, community, would launch an expedition and found a colony. Greeks have been master seafarers since prehistoric times, which is understandable given Greek geography. There are about 6,000 islands in Greece, which are the tops of undersea mountains. Only 227 are currently inhabited. Between the islands and the mainland, Greece has 13,676 kilometers of coastline. In early days, one could island hop from one to the next without losing sight of land for long, if at all. The Greek world was much larger than what we currently think of as Greece. In addition to modern Greece, it included virtually all of western Turkey, Ionia, and parts of Italy, especially Sicily. Scattered Greek colonies ranged all over parts of Africa, Asia, and both Western and Eastern Europe, as far as France and all over the Black Sea. Once formed, a colony was independent from its city of origin. Most of the colonies were embedded within non-Greek areas where they lived with and intermarried with their neighbors. As a result, Greek identity was largely rooted in language and certain aspects of culture. When Alexander the Great embarked upon his campaigns in 334 BCE, the Greek world became the Hellenistic world. He was striving to create the cosmopolis, embodying the idea we are not just citizens of a particular nation, but rather of the cosmos as a whole, and we should bring together what is best in all cultures. The Hellenistic world was one of the greatest cultural mashups of history and included large parts of Europe, all of the Near and Middle East, large sections of Northern Africa, including Egypt, sections of Afghanistan, and for a while, parts of Northern India. When the Greek world came under Roman rule, Rome itself having begun as a colony of another Greek colony, Troy, according to its foundation myths, the Romans maintained many cultural patterns from the Hellenistic world. They continued to use the Greek language for philosophical and intellectual endeavors. When the ancient pagan world fell to Christianity, the term used by Christians for those who maintained their pre-Christian religion was Hellene. They were called Greek, regardless of their actual ethnicity. Our knowledge of ancient Greece extends into prehistory. There are prehistoric sites on Crete, the mainland, and the Cycladic Islands, distinct cultures developing in each. In historical times, the Minoan culture, based on the island of Crete, arose around 2700 BCE. The Mycenaean culture, which was partly contemporaneous with the Minoan, was prominent on the mainland and eventually conquered Crete. Both Minoan and Mycenaean cultures had written language, and scholars have verified that Mycenaean writing, called Linear B, is a form of Greek. The names of almost all the major gods of Greece are found in Linear B, attesting to their archaic origin. Mycenaean culture vanished suddenly around 1050 BCE, and the Greek world entered a dark age. They even forgot how to write. In Greek mythology, the disastrously long war with Troy and all the devastating homecoming stories in which hero after hero returned home to experience tragedy is set in the Mycenaean world's final days and gives a good picture of what the people believed and how they lived. Archaeologists studying the ruins of Troy have dated a great war from about the same time as the collapse of the Mycenaean culture. The mythology of Homer was rooted in this history. During the Dark Ages, the stories continued to be told until writing was reinvented using a modified alphabet from Phoenicia. Our earliest extant writings qualifying as literature are the epics of Homer and the writings of Hesiod, both from the 18th century BCE. From that point on, ancient Greece is a literate culture, persisting until violently disrupted by the Christians. From 381 to 395 CE, under Theodosius, the Christian church waged war against the pagans, forcibly closing and often destroying temples, persecuting priests, and making it illegal to even practice personal piety. Justinian I delivered the final death blow to paganism in the ancient Greek world, forcing the last philosophical schools to close in 529 CE. Beginning with the Minoan and Mycenaean cultures, the time span of what we know as ancient Greece is longer than the time from the fall of ancient Greek paganism to now. In that expanse of time, ancient Greek religion developed and changed. No singular point in time is the true moment of ancient Greek culture. Nothing living is static. Therefore, we should feel no hesitation in designing our practice for our current context. We are a living tradition. Ancient Hellenic culture can give us relevant and interesting models for a global society. Because ancient Greece sent out colonies that were embedded in the midst of other people, they developed an understanding that someone could be culturally Greek if they spoke a Greek language. In most contexts, cultural identity shifted from blood into something that could be learned. This paved the way for the ideal of the cosmopolis, the ideal that embraces the abundance of diversity, but stands on a foundation of the rule of law, the ideal of friendship, and emphasizing the duty we have as citizens of the world. The Greek gods were worshipped by many people who had no Greek blood, and the Greeks adopted many gods that came from elsewhere. Additionally, the Jews, who did not worship any god but their own, were welcomed and incorporated into Greek society. Any attempt to use ancient Greek or Roman society to justify white supremacy is utterly noxious and ahistorical. The concept of white people was created about 1,000 years after the fall of paganism and does not map at all onto ancient concepts. Furthermore, these models can inspire us to look more deeply into our own landscapes and connect with them in a sacred way, even if we are mobile. The Greeks are always connected to the spirits of the waters, the rivers, and the land, no matter where they roamed. Exercise. 3-minute paper on your landscape. This exercise will help you uncover ways your landscape impacts your consciousness. What you'll need: paper or journal, a pen, and a timer. Directions. Set a timer for 3 minutes. Write stream of consciousness, answering the question, how does your landscape shape the way you experience reality? Sources of information. Ancient Greece was literate, and although we have lost a great deal, we have literature, histories, philosophical texts, biographies, records of oracular utterances, and letters. Through inscriptions, we have state records, hymns, and musical notation, and all sorts of fascinating information, like the salary of the priestess of Athena Nike in Athens. Art and archaeological evidence abound. We have historical texts from other contemporary cultures. While I hope you will be inspired to study more, I want to give a few warnings. Be wary of the lenses of later scholars. I read many authors, especially 19th and early 20th century scholars, who bring significant bias to their study and read their own values backward into the ancient world, sometimes relying on polemical Christian sources. For example, these prurient intellectuals had a fascination with the Pythia of Delphi, whom they sexualized and discounted as a frenzied young woman, writhing in ecstasy and spewing nonsense that the intelligent male priests then gave meaning. This interpretation distanced them from the idea that there might be anything real happening in oracular possession that would conflict with their usually Protestant scientific worldview, and placed all the power in the hands of the male priests, reducing the female to a subservient irrational, and sexual role. This is factually wrong. The Pythias were past the age of menopause, spoke clearly, and were known for their modesty, piety, and firmness of mind and character. We have this on such good authority as Plutarch, who was not only a respected philosopher, but also the high priest of Delphi. He wrote essays about how the oracle functioned. Plutarch told a story that one time, the omen that tested if it was safe for the Pythia to prophesy said the ritual should be cancelled, but the omen was ignored. During that one occasion, the Pythia went into a frenzy, a sign that everything was going wrong. Plutarch told that story as a warning not to disobey Apollon's omens, but it was taken out of context by later scholars. Another challenge relates to taking normative, the way things should be, statements from ancient texts as descriptions of the way things actually were. For example, the idea that Athenian women were confined to the household is largely rooted in a reading of Xenophon's Economicus that takes his statement to that effect literally. I argue that he was offering an upper-class ideal rather than describing lived reality. Let me be clear. If you could transport me back in time, I would not want to live as a woman in ancient Greece. I would find it oppressive and restrictive. I certainly wouldn't want to live as a slave woman. I believe there is tremendous wisdom worth recovering, and I believe the gods are real. But I am not interested in recreating social forms. Another challenge is that translations can inhibit understanding. An example is the use of the English word rape. Reading English language translations, the gods constantly raping mortal women is horrifying. However, looking at the historical evidence, I don't see an ancient Greek concept that means precisely the same thing as our rape, which emphasizes lack of sexual consent. In ancient Greece, women's sexual lives were defined by their arranged marriages. Female sexuality was subservient to the oikos, the family and household, which was the foundational institution of society. Many situations translated as rape involve women who have sexual intercourse outside of marriage but bear no moral blame. This includes sexual violence, but also other circumstances we would not think of as rape. It seems to include marriage by elopement, consensual or not, but not agreed to by the household. And every time a god had sex with a mortal woman, consensual or not, every child born needed to have a place in a family. As a patrilineal society, a child belonged in the father's family. In cases of extramarital sex where the mother was blameless, the child had a place in her father's family. This includes children of the gods. Myths are sacred stories, operating at many levels of consciousness. Taking them literally misses most of their power. Be careful with Ovid. Ovid, an accomplished Roman poet, is the primary source of many of our English language books about Greek mythology. Compilations of mythic stories was not a genre in ancient Greece, but is what Ovid provides in Metamorphoses. It is a literary masterpiece exploring the theme of transformation, but is not a sacred text, and unlike the myths themselves, has no relationship to religious cult. For mythological sources, I recommend starting with hymns. Unverified Personal Gnosis, UPG. In recounting Persia's invasion of Greece, Herodotus tells a story of Pheidippides, an Athenian long-distance runner. When the Athenian generals realized they were going to meet the vastly superior Persian force at Marathon, they sent Pheidippides to run about 100 miles to Sparta and beg for their aid. Pheidippides ran all the way without a break and tried, in vain, to convince the Spartans. When he was unsuccessful, knowing the Athenian strategy hinged on Sparta's decision, he immediately ran back, desperately trying to reach the generals in time. On his return journey, the god Pan appeared and asked why he wasn't worshipped in Athens. Pan pledged to help the Athenians if they would promise to build him a temple. Pheidippides told the generals, who promised Pan they would. During the battle, many Persian soldiers were seized by Pan Ik and neutralized.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?